Welcome to the EI Podcast. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas. And today, we're looking at the unsung architects of the post-war world. And joining me is Peter Ricketts, former British Ambassador to France and crossbench peer. And we're going to discuss his latest book, Peacemakers Shaping the Modern World, The Men and Women of the Foreign Office in World War II. So, Peter, a very warm welcome to the podcast. I wonder if you could give our listeners an overview of what the book is about, and I suppose as well, important, why you felt the need to write it, and why now?
Well, Paul, thank you very much indeed for having me on the podcast. I'll declare a background in that I was a diplomat for 40 years, and so it's an institution I know extremely well, the Foreign Office. And I always felt that somehow it had been airbrushed out of our national story about the Second World War, which is dominated, of course, by Churchill, by the generals, by the battles, the spies. But the diplomats were also doing fascinating and sometimes very surprising things as part of winning the war. And then, as you said, in thinking ahead to shape the future peace when the war was over. And I've been collecting the anecdotes and the stories for years, and I thought it was worth writing it because I do think that the men and the women deserve their place in the spotlight. Nothing really has been written about women in the Foreign Office, and reasons we can come on to, but they were there, there were many of them, and they did some quite remarkable things.
And your book opens with a really gripping narrative sequence. The very chaotic retreat of the British embassy from Paris as the Nazis advanced in those very dark days in 1940. It reminded me slightly, I'd been reading Olivia Manning's Balkan trilogy, and there is a chaotic element to that, roughly contemporaneous with it. But I wonder if you could set the scene for our listeners, those who haven't read your book, and get a sense of what this onset of total war, what did it actually mean for British diplomats, not just in Paris and France, but across this crumbling Europe?
It's surprising looking back that that phony war period between September of 39 and the spring of 1940, life continued pretty much as usual in a city like Paris. And then the onslaught launched by the Germans on the 10th of May, which actually was the same day that Churchill came into Downing Street as Prime Minister, suddenly made people start panicking, because they moved forward extremely fast. And in the embassy in Paris, having been a bit complacent, I think, about the probability the French would hold out at least for a time, suddenly they found themselves burning the secret papers in the stove of the embassy and preparing to evacuate. It was not made easy by Churchill wanting to come all the time and try and shore up the French. And there are stories of his whirlwind passages, first of all through Paris, and then as the embassy followed the French government, retreating first to the Loire Valley at Tours and then to Bordeaux in the southwest. Again, Churchill continued to come. So there are stories about how they were helping British people out of France at that time, while also trying to get out themselves. Endless people came demanding passage out on ships as the German armies approached, including King Zog of Albania, who turned up with his treasure in three or four very heavy boxes. He was got away safely. As the embassy left, everybody piled their luggage into the front hall of our magnificent residence, which I had the privilege of being a tenant of when I was ambassador. So they put everything in, they locked the door, they left it in the care of a gatekeeper, David Christie. A year later, Hermann Göring, in full Reichsmarschall uniform, knocked at the gate, demanded to come in. He wanted it for his residence. David Christie said, this is internationally protected, you're not coming in over my dead body, and slammed the door. They did pick him up and keep him in prison for a few weeks, but amazingly then let him out. And then when Duff Cooper, the ambassador after the war, arrived to reopen, get relations going again after the fall of Paris, the embassy was untouched. So it was a quite remarkable period. But the scramble to get people out and then to get embassies out was going on all around Europe. Ambassadors and their staffs were staying until very late in the process to make sure they got out. One unfortunate ambassador, the ambassador to Belgium, Lancelot Oliphant, left it too late. and he got cut off by the approaching German armies. He was hiding under a juniper bush on the Channel coast at a little place called Fort Mahon Plage, and he thought, actually, this is not very diplomatic to be found under a bush. So he surrendered, and he was incarcerated and kept in internment for over a year. And that was a fate that also happened to other diplomats, as perhaps we can talk about.
And what was the status of those diplomats? I mean, was there any way out of that? Was that what happened to them? They were just arrested. They were in prison for the duration of the war, I presume.
That was the risk, yes. I mean, diplomats remain diplomats even when you've cut off relations. And the custom is that you exchange your diplomats. So for the German embassy people in London, we exchange for the British embassy people in Paris. But that takes some time. In case of Oliphant, he was interned for a year, kept in kind of police academies and so on. The embassy people in Tokyo had a much more difficult time, because when the Japanese declared war, and we declared war on Japan after Pearl Harbor, instantly the Japanese crowded all the British community in Tokyo onto the British embassy compound, which luckily is quite large. And they shut them in, they took away their radios, they cut them off from the world for 8 months while arrangements were made to exchange them with the Japanese people from London. In that 8 months, there is fascinating newsletters that they put around the compound every day, reflecting a very British social life they set up in complete isolation, had no idea what was going on in the world. There were tennis ladders, there were bridge parties, there was a pantomime at Christmas, musical evenings, language lessons given by the spouses. You get a very vivid sense of this British community wanting to be very British, like a kind of English country club, in the extraordinary period where they had no contact at all with what was going on outside. So a lot of keep calm and carry on required in those circumstances. But that's something that happens to diplomats. If you suddenly find yourself at war at short notice and you can't get out, you are interned, and maybe for quite a long time.
I've read a lot of diplomatic history going back to the 16th and 17th centuries, and it has a reputation, sometimes deserved, for being as dry as dust. That's not a charge that could be made against peacemakers, I don't think. It's a wonderful book. And it's full of characters. What it is an ensemble piece, I think it's fair to say. But perhaps the closest figure to a central pillar in the book is Sir Alexander Cadogan. Those who are unfamiliar with Cadogan's life, I wonder if you could tell us a little about this extraordinary figure.
With great pleasure. He was the permanent undersecretary for the Foreign Office throughout the war, from 1938 under Lord Halifax as Foreign Secretary, all the way through to Bevin in 46. I felt particular kinship with him because I later became permanent undersecretary myself. And I put on the wall of the permanent secretary's office, grand office in the Foreign Office, a document which Alexander Cadogan had drawn up at Churchill's request at the first summit with Roosevelt on the HMS Prince of Wales in Placentia Bay in Canada, the Atlantic summit. Roosevelt demanded some sort of statement of the principles that would guide the Allies in the future peace. And Cadogan sat down at the Admiral's table and wrote out 8 or 9 principles with no support, which then eventually became the Atlantic Charter and then fed directly into the United Nations. I was fascinated by this man. A young son of the very grand Cadogan family, who owned Cadogan Square and much else in London, been a diplomat for many years, was our man at the League of Nations for years, so knew about international diplomacy, was made permanent undersecretary by Chamberlain and Halifax at the time of appeasement. But he was both running the Foreign Office and keeping a handle on all the foreign policy advice that went to the Foreign Secretary, and also became Churchill's closest foreign policy advisor. Churchill really trusted him. So he was at all the cabinet meetings late into the night. He was drafting the Churchill messages to Roosevelt and Stalin, while at the same time trying to cope with the business in the Foreign Office. And he was calm, collected, measured individual, slightly buttoned up. When his diaries were published 10 or 15 years later, a different Cadogan was revealed. Emotional, caustic, funny. He'd obviously bottled all that up and poured it out into his diary in the evening, which makes a fascinating day-by-day commentary on the ups and downs of the war.
And how would you rank that among the diaries of wartime? There are many very good ones. Alan Brooke, for example.
Indeed. It's rather like Alan Brooke seen from a civilian perspective. It's sparkling. It's immediate. It's vivid. And Alan Brooke and Cadogan both sat at some of these cabinet meetings with Churchill, went back home, often both of them, and wrote furiously in their diary about how impossible Churchill was to deal with. So it's a very, very direct take on one man's war with the ups and downs of that. But it was a man who was at the centre of affairs throughout.
Now, you mentioned appeasement there. It's a fact that civil servants are tasked with implementing the policies of elected MPs, whether they agree with those policies or not. But I wonder if there was any sense during the years of appeasement, particularly as it reached the crisis, the Munich crisis and beyond, whether there were any fractures that were apparent in the Foreign Office at that point.
I think views among the Foreign Office people probably reflected views in wider society. There were some who were for, some who were against. And the previous permanent undersecretary, Sir Cadogan, was called Lord von Sittard. He was ferociously anti-German and peppered Chamberlain with angry memos, you know, telling him he'd got to toughen up, to the point where Chamberlain got completely sick of him and fired him, or actually moved him upstairs to a job that didn't really exist called Chief Diplomatic Advisor and brought Cadogan in. So I think everybody had doubts. Cadogan's skill was to try to bring ministers to accept that there have to be limits to our policy. We can't keep giving way to Hitler. And certainly after Munich, Cadogan and others were absolutely clear that we were on the wrong course. Indeed, Cadogan spoke pretty harshly to Halifax one evening, and Halifax indeed pretty much reversed engines after Munich and then became strongly against any further concessions to Hitler. The diplomats asked themselves after the breakout of war, you know, had they been in the right place? And a number of their diaries and memoirs are, you know, worrying about that. Most of them, I think, felt that actually in the run-up to Munich, it was right to buy another year of time to complete the rearmament of the country. I mean, that's now very arguable, but I think at the time that probably seemed like the right thing to do. But those who actually accompanied Chamberlain to Munich really found it, you know, horrible to be in the same room as Hitler, to shake Hitler's hand. The young diplomat called Yvonne Kirkpatrick, who records that, you know, he physically sort of recoiled from shaking Hitler's hand. And, you know, they worried about it for the rest of their lives, but they tended to kind of rationalise it in that way.
But life also shifted quite drastically for people, for those civil servants left in London. And so what did their day-to-day look like once war was declared, during the phony war, once war became active? What did it look like for this Foreign Office Home Guard?
Well, you're right. The Foreign Office people shared with all Londoners all the hardships of the Blitz, while also trying to crack out advice to ministers on really difficult policy decisions. They had blackout blinds. They had the people who had to work 24/7, like the people who deciphered and ciphered the telegrams, which were essential for keeping contact around the world. They moved into the basement, many of them young women, actually, because the men had been called up for war. Everybody was expected to muck in and do their thing. So you were expected to volunteer either to be in the Home Guard and told to do square bashing and walk around the corridors at night with, you know, bayonets fixed. Although a number of senior diplomats asked themselves, what on earth would we do if we ever met a German? Or fire watch on the roof, which meant scrambling over the roofs at night, watching out for incendiaries, because Foreign Office is an enormous building, incendiary bomb could do huge damage. And so you were doing one or the other of those. Any able-bodied man was expected to volunteer for that. And so there was that sense, I think, that we're all in it together. They worked extremely long hours. There was very sort of amateur weekend cover provided by a group called the Resident Clerks, who were young bachelors who agreed to do their week's work and have a flat in the Foreign Office and take it in turns to cover weekends and nights, which basically meant no sleep. So pretty hand-to-mouth, slightly kind of gentleman amateur style. But even Cadogan decided he had to do fire watching on the roof at his age, late 50s, because he wanted to set an example that we were all in this together.
But one of the major strengths, and you've already picked up on this, of peacemakers, is the way in which it uncovers stories of women who force their way, is that the right phrase, into what was a very fiercely patriarchal institution at that point. You've got these great characters, Elizabeth Viscerman, I hope I've pronounced that right, Freya Stark, of course, who's quite well known, Nancy Lambton, all utterly fascinating figures. And I want to get into the character of them. They have this very fierce personal conviction to do this work, despite some of the obstacles the Foreign Office throws in their way. And often, even when they're there, they refuse to take them entirely seriously.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, just to set the scene, yes, the diplomatic service was elitist and was entirely male. I mean, by statute, women could not become diplomats. That means the higher level of civil servants in the Foreign Office. And most of them, because of the entrance exam system, had been to public school and Oxford, because that was kind of the way you expected to come in. There were women pre-war in the Foreign Office. All of them were secretaries or clerks. And the Foreign Office doctrine was, well, women couldn't really serve abroad in a representative way because, well, you know, the culture wouldn't work for it. A number of women proved that. I mean, they blew that out of the water. You mentioned Elizabeth Viscerman. She is one of the three women I felt that their whole lives had been a preparation for what they did in the war. She, after Cambridge, had become a German expert. She was a correspondent, a journalist in Germany.
And was from a German background.
Yes, it was partly German, spoke fluent German, spent a lot of time in Berlin in the 30s watching the rise of the Nazis. At one point got picked up and interrogated by the Gestapo. After that, she was more on the fringes of Germany. And she made it a speciality to understand Czechoslovakia, and particularly the Sudetenland, the German-speaking part of Czechoslovakia, which became the flashpoint around Munich. In fact, she wrote a book on the Czechs and the Germans for Chatham House, published in 1938, just before Munich. So her whole background was really... She volunteered to work, and she was picked up by a sort of hush-hush part of the Foreign Office called the Political Intelligence Department, sent to Switzerland, which was one of those neutral capitals where German agents, businessmen, British, others, all mixed in a very ambiguous sort of world of shadowy corners and people trying to work out were you who you said you were. Think of the film Casablanca. It's a bit Casablanca in the middle of Europe. And Elizabeth Viscerman was in her element there. She had friends and contact networks across occupied Europe, including in Italy when they became also an adversary. And London peppered her with demands to know what was the social situation like in Germany, you know, what were attitudes in Austria, you know, was there an anti-Mussolini movement in Italy? And she would go all around Switzerland having quiet lunches and dinners and picking up political intelligence, basically, without any diplomatic status. She finally persuaded the men to put her on the diplomatic list, which gave her a little bit of safety. But at the end of the war, she decided she wasn't going to join the Foreign Office because of the misogyny she'd found. Freya Stark, I mean, ditto, she was an Arab expert. Before the war, well known as a traveller, an adventurer, a writer on the Arab world. She joined the Ministry of Information, worked for the Foreign Office in Aden, and was sent up country to Sana, which must be one of the most remote places. She found her secret weapon was she could get into the harem. And then she'd make friends with the women. And then when the great men came home and sort of took off their robes and relaxed, then she got at them to put across the British message. And she set up networks called Brotherhoods of Freedom in Iraq and Egypt, several thousand each. She was a kind of influencer before the term was invented. Remarkably strong woman. The last one, Nancy Lambton. She was a Persian specialist. She'd learnt Persian in London. The embassy in Tehran discovered her playing tennis one afternoon in 1939, asked her to be the press secretary, which she was throughout the war, and was able to deal perfectly competently with Iranians and combat German influence. All three women really showed that the Foreign Office logic, you know, was completely wrong. None of them decided to stay on. Because of the continued toxic tone in the Foreign Office. But in 1946, the bar to women joining the diplomatic service was lifted. The reason we didn't have many senior women for so many years was that there was a marriage bar until 1973. Quite remarkable. Any woman in the Foreign Office who married had to resign until 1973. So these were pioneering women, but it still took a long time for women to really establish themselves in the Foreign Office.
And there was another legacy of women such as them, because the civil service, although it had this marriage bar, which seems so incredibly archaic to us, but it did commit to equal pay between the sexes in 55, which was quite in advance of the Equal Pay Act, which was 1970. I mean, was it the activities of people such as those wartime women that accelerated this process?
Yes, I think so, because across the civil service and in the Foreign Office, women flocked to the departments because most of the men were called up, and recruitment of men into the civil service was barred while the war went on. So you find many, many women running, of course, all the secretaries, most of the clerical staff, almost all the telegram cipherers, sharing the dangers and demands with the men in postings abroad. And I think the contribution of women overall is one of the reasons why that ban got lifted.
And the book is wonderfully colourful, because it's peppered with eccentrics, we might call them, certainly vivid characters who operate somewhere on what we might call the fringes of diplomacy. We've got Francis Darcy Osborne, who spent a long time, 4 years or so, essentially trapped in the Vatican. And there's Archibald Clarke Kerr, who was a very eccentric ambassador to the Soviet Union in Moscow, who was able, managed to befriend Stalin, even. I just wonder how, what it is about these very, very wildly different personalities that allows them to succeed, perhaps, where traditional diplomacy might have failed, or what we associate with traditional diplomacy might have failed.
Yes, I think both stories show how people can rise to exceptional moments and find perhaps strengths they didn't know they had. Francis Osborne was a scholarly, bookish, rather retiring man who is our ambassador to the Vatican, to the Holy See, since 1936. He lived in Rome but was ambassador to the Vatican. When Italy declared war, of course, the Vatican became a neutral enclave, a kind of gilded cage surrounded by hostile territory. The Foreign Office decided he should move into the Vatican. He went in, camped in a kind of convent with his butler, his secretary, and his dog, Jeremy. And they had him there because they wanted him to tap into the very large Catholic networks across occupied Europe, again, to pick up political intelligence. And he was very successful in that. Indeed, I think he got some early indications of the Holocaust. But then as Allied armies landed in Sicily and moved up Italy, he set up from within the Vatican an escape line for Allied prisoners of war. I mean, not something a man like that would ever have thought of doing. He found wandering about outside the Vatican a couple of escaped British officers, one called Sam Derry. He brought them in clandestinely, hid them in his operation in the convent. And with them, he organized an escape line that helped thousands of British prisoners to safety. It became famous with a book and a film called The Scarlet and the Black, which highlighted a Catholic priest, Monsignor O'Flaherty, who was also very brave in this. But it was Darcy Osborne behind the scenes orchestrating a large Allied escape line. Quite a remarkable story. Archie Clarke Kerr, very different, very worldly. He loved dirty jokes and alcohol and smoking. He'd been ambassador in Nationalist China. He was a kind of larger-than-life figure, and the Foreign Office decided rightly that he would be very good to match Stalin and get alongside him. And so when he arrived, he did find that, you know, by giving him plentiful tobacco and lots of dirty stories, he established a relationship with Stalin. When Churchill went on his first visit to Moscow in 1942, pretty pivotal because the alliance with Russia was part of the war-winning strategy, the first banquet at the Kremlin went very badly. And Churchill stormed out, thinking that Stalin had insulted him, decided he'd go home. I mean, he wasn't going to have this Russian peasant talking to him like that. Could have been a disaster to, you know, to ruin the idea of an alliance. Clarke Kerr took him for a walk in the woods and said to him, pretty bluntly, I think, look, you know, you're being stupid here. You know, you are a great statesman. We need to work with the Russians. He is a Russian peasant. You know, don't let him wind you up like that. Go back, have a proper meeting with him and get things sorted out. And although Churchill was pretty, you know, fed up about that, he took the advice. He went back And for the rest of the war, Churchill dined out on the fact that he had a very special personal relationship with Stalin, whether he did or not, but Clark Kerr kept the things on the rails. And I think, therefore, you know, in a small way, that was part of a war-winning contribution the Foreign Office made.
And also part of that war-winning enterprise was the United States, which entered the war in December 1941. And the sheer scale of Allied resources would shift overnight and exponential. But how did the arrival of the Americans alter the daily reality for British diplomats, for British civil servants, and especially the leverage they had?
Well, first of all, it led to an enormous expansion of our embassy in Washington, which became a sort of Whitehall on the Potomac of several thousand civil servants engaging with the Americans on everything from, you know, from commodities, from shipping, from lend lease, and all the thousands of areas where we had to cooperate. I mean, it meant that the very top-level diplomacy happened between Churchill and Roosevelt, who sent each other endless messages and endless telephone calls. Churchill sent Lord Halifax, the former Foreign Secretary, to be ambassador, and so he was almost like a member of the cabinet in Washington. He wasn't really so involved in the high diplomacy, but in every other aspect, the embassy were coordinating, keeping things on the rails, also trying to keep Churchill working with Roosevelt and Stalin, sometimes damping down Churchill's irritation and anger when things weren't going his way. So the Foreign Office was very instrumental in keeping that relationship on the road. Another key relationship where they had to play marriage broker was with General de Gaulle, who arrived in London after France fell. I mean, that also could easily have gone seriously wrong because Churchill and de Gaulle were always having great titanic rows. And Anthony Eden and Alec Cadogan were usually the ones who went round afterwards, picked up the pieces and said, no, you've got to get on with de Gaulle. You know, he's going to be vital after the war to keep France out of the hands of communists and, you know, on the right side. And so those sorts of relationships, Stalin, de Gaulle, Roosevelt, were ones where the Foreign Office could help ensure that the Churchill bulldozer was pointing in the right direction.
And one thread through your book is the idea of duty for the civil servants, for diplomats and politicians as well. I think it's fair to say in their engagements with one another. Now, you served at the highest levels of British diplomacy. I wonder if you feel today's political class, its diplomats, its civil servants, do they hold that same institutional sense of duty, and has it changed over time?
It obviously has changed over time. Wartime is a very special time. I mean, nobody would ever complain about an order to, you know, go to a faraway country and live there for 4 years with no contact with your family. I mean, that was the war. People took extraordinary risks in the air travel. The lady, Heather Ochterlony, was with Eden on a plane, went out to Malta on the way to Yalta in 1945. The following plane crashed and killed everyone. And yet Heather got on the plane again the next morning to fly to Yalta without flinching. So people put up with the risks, I think, in a way that perhaps today there would be more hesitation. Another thing that characterizes that period is the security. I mean, they didn't have leaks. Nowadays, I think the relationship between politicians and diplomats and civil servants is constantly poisoned by leaks. And therefore, the diplomats feel unwilling to speak truth to power because it might leak. But the documents of the Foreign Office show that the Foreign Office people, Cadogan and others, would say things very frankly to ministers if they thought they were getting it wrong. And there was never any danger of reading that in the Daily Mail the next day. So that is also a change of the culture.
And as the war drew to a close, the creation of what became the United Nations is advanced. It becomes what you might call the ultimate diplomatic objective. Mm. So how was the UN sold to the world? Is it a grand ideal? Certainly there's a large element of that. It's a very idealistic project. But there's also a pragmatic sense, I feel, that it's also there to manage what is a very brutal, great power, especially in the light of the Soviet Union's ambitions. I wonder if you could give us a flavour of those objectives and those intentions.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the remarkable things, I think, is that right in the middle of the war, with everybody else in the British government concentrated entirely on winning the war, the Foreign Office set up a team to think about the future peace. Alec Cadogan chose one of his best brains, Gladwin Jebb, and a small team, and they went away up into an attic, had nothing to do with the war, and just thought about what kind of peace do we want to follow this cataclysm. Bearing in mind, these people had lived through two world wars. And by 1945, I think, to answer your question, there was a strong sense around the place, perhaps a bit idealistic, that we cannot let this happen again. We need to have an international organization that is strong enough to keep the peace. From 1942, the Foreign Office were designing that institution. The blueprints came from London. Others were being designed in Washington. And gradually, the two merged their thinking into an approach which we have now, a General Assembly for all the countries of the world, a Security Council with a smaller number of countries, and within that, permanent members, the great powers of the time. And that was sold, essentially, it was rammed through. It was first agreed with the Russians, the Soviets, and then with the Chinese, and then presented to a wider group of countries. And there was quite a long negotiation in San Francisco before they signed, but basically it was not quite take it or leave it, but the plan basically survived. And in the end, all the countries that then existed as independent countries, I think there were 61 countries who signed it, they all accepted it. The Foreign Office crew knew that at the heart of it there was a big flaw, because they'd had to concede the veto power for any permanent member. They did that because if they hadn't, neither the Americans nor the Soviets would have signed up. And so they thought, the pragmatic side, that it's better to take the best deal you can get rather than go for the pure, perfect deal and fail. But because of that, they were also thinking by 1945 about European security arrangements. What do we do if, when the Soviets, break their commitments and threaten us again? And that laid the foundations for what became NATO in 1945. And one last piece of forward thinking, the Foreign Office also led work between the Americans and the Soviets on the occupation regime for Germany when Germany surrendered, which clearly it was by 1944, it was clear they were going to lose. And by the time 45 came, they had all the surrender arrangements, the occupation regimes ready to implement. In the end, the occupation didn't go as they intended because the Soviets insisted on basically making communist their sector in the east. But very quickly, the Federal Republic of Germany emerged, and that is partly due to the forward thinking in the Foreign Office. So I do think it's a lesson for today that even in the midst of world crisis, you need to be thinking of how to come out of it in a better position.
So we have this new world order after 1945 for all its flaws. And you talk about it unraveling in 2003, the invasion of Iraq. And why do you think it unraveled then? And I suppose just as importantly, do you think there's any hope left for a return to a rules-based order?
In the end, all international orders break down. The realities on which they were founded change, economic shifts, demographic shifts, and so on. I think the UN was never perfect. I mean, right from the Korean War in 1950, the great powers of the time were at loggerheads. But it did provide a framework and some guardrails about how countries should treat each other. I think after the end of the Soviet Union, the West thought that basically we'd won. And I think the Iraq War was such a turning point because the Americans and the British went to war with Iraq, arguably without a decent legal base. And since we were the champions of the UN Charter, that set a very bad lesson for autocrats around the world. And both Xi Jinping and Putin have very much jumped on that. So as we've gone from a world which was American-dominated in the post-Cold War period to the return of great power rivalry, with the emergence of China as a real global superpower and Russia as a declining but reckless and dangerous power, the UN can't operate in those circumstances. So there are bits of the UN that work. The agencies are doing great work in the humanitarian area on child or public health issues. But essentially, I think the idea of a single place where the world can come together in our fractured world is now impossible. And can we recreate it? I don't think we can. without another global catastrophe on the scale of the Second World War. It's only in those situations where you can bring people together to say never again. So I don't wish that. I think, therefore, we've got to depend on our regional alliances like NATO, get closer to the EU, because replacing the international framework, I don't think, is a starter.
Well, thank you, Peter Ricketts, Lord Ricketts, for sharing your expertise, born of many decades of experience in diplomacy, and most of all for your wonderful book, Peacemakers. We highly recommend it. It's a joy to read. It's the best kind of diplomatic history, I think. So thank you.
It's been a real pleasure, Paul. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.